From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In its annual report released today, Amnesty International says that the war on terror has seriously undercut human rights across the globe. The report, representing the human rights organization's work in 2002, was compiled before the U.S.-led war in Iraq, but its monitors now say that that war has only exacerbated an already deteriorating global human rights landscape. In 150 countries, from El Salvador to Egypt to the USA, Amnesty reports on arrests, detentions, and deportations of suspects without trial. It compiles torture incidents and executions. It tracks racial profiling and its consequences. As the world grapples with terrorism and struggles to keep citizens safe, governments, the report says, are exploiting the international climate favoring anti-terrorism. Tonight on Point, human rights, the war on terror, and the controversial price of security. Do you see the war on terror eroding human rights? Must human rights and security be at odds? Is Amnesty International focused on the right problem here? Do you put the fight for human rights above the fight against terrorism? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Joshua Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International. He's been involved in human rights and international affairs for 28 years. He's an expert on Soviet history and author of several books on the Soviet Union and Russia, including Stalin's Secret Pogrom. Good evening and welcome, Josh Rubenstein.
It's good to be here.
It's great to have you also with us in the studio tonight, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Josh.
Hi, Jack.
Josh Rubenstein, take us in here. Pretty tough words from Amnesty International today. Let me quote from a statement that Amnesty put out. It says, "Far from making the world a safer place, the war has made it more dangerous by curtailing human rights, undermining the rule of international law, and shielding governments from scrutiny. It has deepened divisions among people of different faiths and origins, sowing the seeds for more conflict." So what would Amnesty International have the United States do?
Well, first, let's be very clear. Something terrible happened on 9/11. We all understand the government had the obligation to protect us from further attacks. There was great fear and anxiety. But it's also the case that it's the role of a human rights organization, of any civil rights organization in a democracy, to draw red lines. That it's easy to defend human rights at a time of calm prosperity. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of challenge to defend human rights at a moment of crisis. But we do not believe that we should suspend these principles at a moment of crisis. We believe we should look to these principles to guide us through these crises so we don't look back with regret. So therefore, when the U.S. responds to a terrible kind of attack that we witnessed on September 11th and some of us suffered, we should make sure we do not engage in torture and we do not allow our allies to engage in torture. That if people are arrested, they have the right to see a lawyer. If they're held indefinitely, they should be brought to an open and fair trial of some kind. That there should not be executions. That people should not be deported to countries where they could face torture. These are principles that should not be abandoned.
So there are two phases to this, Josh Rubenstein. One inside the United States. We'll talk about that. But I wish you'd look first. I've got this big fat book here, country by country, through many countries.
151 countries.
151. And what we're hearing, top line, is that the kind of effects of the war on terror have crept out. The long fingers have crept out into many of these countries and produced negative human rights effects. Can you describe some of those in detail? Give us some examples.
Well, sure. Look at Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan has a long history in the post-Soviet period of being a repressive place. I was on a mission to Tashkent in 1994. We interviewed families of prisoners of conscience. We interviewed families whose members were on death row, had been executed.
Well before 2001.
The point is that the situation there is even worse. Tensions between the government and so-called Islamist groups are worse. People are being tortured. There are continuing executions. But now the U.S. pays less attention. And now the government of Uzbekistan can say, on the one hand, we're helping the U.S. This is a staging area for flights into Afghanistan. On the other hand, let us do what we want to our so-called opponents. Let us compromise the rule of law. Let us engage in torture. And the U.S. will more or less give us a free ride.
Are you telling us that before 9/11, 2001, the United States would have gone into Uzbekistan and said, you've got to clean this up, and now they're just ignoring it? Is it just a sin of omission here? Is there commission as well? Is there some positive impact? I mean, to say, is there some impact of the war on terror that actually produces more
oppression, I guess, in Uzbekistan?
First, once the government feels it has a more of a green light from democratic countries like the United States, then it casts a wider net over who is a so-called opponent. So, yes, there may well be groups who are associated with al-Qaeda. We'd want Uzbekistan to investigate. But that doesn't mean they have the right just to torture anyone and tar them with the name, well, they must be al-Qaeda, because everyone in Uzbekistan is probably a Muslim. And in the post-Soviet period, there are more mosques. People are engaged in Islamic study. That's perfectly legitimate. But the government uses this crackdown on the war on terrorism to brand everyone with that brush.
So we get it in principle. But in detail, has Amnesty been able to draw lines and say, here are incidents where the local government said, picked up, somebody and tortured them or imprisoned them wrongly and justified it in the name of the U.S.-led war on terror? Is it that clear?
Well, yes. Look at Chechnya. We've had the first war in the mid-90s where there were terrible abuses. It was a miserable war. The war again breaks out in the late 1990s. All of a sudden, there's the attack on 9/11. And now we hear the claim that the war in Chechnya is really part of the broader war on terrorism, where we know there are local roots to this conflict, this terrible conflict. Yes, there may well be people from outside of Chechnya who have gone there to exploit this situation. But basically, this is a problem between the Russians, the Russian Federation, Vladimir Putin, and a group in Chechnya that wants to break away. And it has local roots. But Putin has exploited this war on terrorism, and the U.S. has not been as tough on Russia and human rights abuses associated with the war in Chechnya since 9/11. I think that's a very vivid example.
Give us more examples. The report is just out today. It's big, it's fat, it's deep. Is the stuff really in there to support these very tough statements by the Amnesty International top brass?
Absolutely. Look at Pakistan. After all, the U.S. pressed for a return to democracy in Pakistan in the 1980s and the 1990s. General Musharraf took over the government of Pakistan before 9/11. Since 9/11, he's been given a very free hand to round up people, to use torture, to deport people to the U.S., where it's not clear what procedures were invoked. And yet we have virtually nothing to say. We, the U.S. government, nothing to say about human rights violations in Pakistan, because they are seen as such a vivid ally, a necessary ally against the government of the Taliban and for what we want to do in Afghanistan. So democracy in Pakistan is no longer a front burner issue for the United States.
Jack Beatty, here we are, a real terror threat. We saw it on 9/11. We've seen it again since then, even within the last couple of weeks. Plenty of dead. Requiring some kind of response. Now Amnesty International stands up and says, net-net, this war on terror has produced a darker, more dangerous, less humane world. What's going on here?
Well, of course, the argument that our people make is this is about security and that human rights is a secondary consideration and we have to be safe above everything. But a British diplomat in Kyrgyzstan, next door to Uzbekistan, mm-hmm. challenged that in an interview today in The Guardian, where he was pointing to the human rights situation there. There again, we have a base. There again, there's a tremendously repressive government, 6,000 political prisoners. Last summer, two men were boiled alive from one of these radical Islamist groups. And the British diplomat said, not only is this terrible for the people involved, but this is making enemies against the United States and against the West. He says, after all, what is it that gave rise to al-Qaeda? Al-Qaeda is an organization, but it's also a movement. That is, it can tap into a movement of resentment of what? Precisely Western, going along with repressive regimes for our oil and for our security. So what are we doing now? For the sake of our security, we're blinking our eyes to their human rights. And the British diplomat was saying, where do you think Al-Qaeda's members are going to come from? The relatives of the people who were boiled alive in a country to which we now give aid and say good things about.
And yet, I ask again, Josh Rubenstein, what is Amnesty International suggesting here? I mean, crimes have been committed. There's a police action in response. It's global. We call it the war on terror, and it's more than a police action in many dimensions, I grant you. But Americans expect their government to stand up and do something here.
And we want them to do something, and we want them to bring those responsible for either the attacks on 9/11 or these other attacks that have taken place since. But it's our job, the job of a human rights organization, to remind us of first principles. The fact that the U.S. would blink at the issue of torture, that there's evidence that two people were tortured to death at the hands of U.S. forces in Afghanistan in December, that was reported by the Washington Post. The fact that, according to what I heard this morning, actually on the radio, that they're building permanent facilities at Guantanamo that may include an execution chamber for people who do not have lawyers. It's not clear what kind of tribunals they will be brought before, and yet we are already building an execution chamber. Let's face it, these are things that send a message to the world that says, yes, we are champions of human rights, champions of democracy, but we'll be the first to compromise on these issues in the face of a security threat. Now, what message does it send to governments whose institutions, whose democratic institutions, are more fragile than ours?
Your Secretary General of Amnesty International, Irene Khan, writes that the United States has undermined its own moral authority to speak out against human rights violations in other parts of the world. What about the situation in the United States itself? The report addresses that as well, Josh Rubenstein. What does Amnesty International have to say about human rights in the United States?
Well, first, there are several issues that we have addressed for many, many years, like the death penalty, like the treatment of refugees, like instances of police brutality. Those we continue to follow, and they're very disturbing. But we are concerned at what's happening in Guantanamo. That may not be within the borders of the United States, but that's being carried out by our federal government. The fact that there are, I believe, two people in custody in the United States who are not being given lawyers, who we claim are enemy combatants.
These are American citizens without legal representation.
I do not believe that our security would be compromised if they had the right to see lawyers. That is a fundamental principle, and I think we should be very wary of any government that would compromise on that principle. These are the kinds of things we are very worried about. Racial profiling at these detention centers where people from Muslim and Arab countries have been called in to be registered. There's no evidence in any individual case that they were involved in any serious crime. Some, when they come to register the last few months, have been taken into custody, and their relatives are having trouble finding them. And there's some evidence of mistreatment because feelings are aroused after 9/11, and a whole group of people is being branded as potential terrorists, as potential criminals, with no evidence for them as individuals. But our criminal justice system is founded on the belief you hold individuals responsible, not groups.
Is Amnesty International asking the United States to confront terrorism, terrorists, with one hand tied behind its back in such a way that it cannot win the war?
I think that's a very unfortunate metaphor. We're not asking for anyone to be soft on crime. We insist that people responsible for these crimes be brought to justice. What has our work been for 40 years, if not a cry in the wilderness in defense of victims? That's our job. But when the government goes out in this kind of climate and claims it's in a war on terrorism and then begins to compromise on these fundamental values, then I think that's very worrisome. I think, for example, the debate we had in this country over the possible use of military tribunals in the fall of 2001, when human rights organizations like Amnesty were saying, no, trust the federal court system. Use the federal court system, federal district court. They are capable. We stood up for the integrity of these institutions when the White House and the Department of Justice were reluctant to go to federal district court to try Mr. Massawi or Mr. Reed. In the end, they went to those courts. That was the right decision.
Jack Beatty, Amnesty is clamoring here.
Yes, and they have credibility. Your report on Iraq in recent years has been even cited by the administration. Precisely,
well,
as
document, human rights abuses human in, right, Iraq. In Iraq. So the State Department quotes Amnesty,
yes,
but this year, I don't know.
Well, the point is with Iraq that we have a record of more than 20 years of criticizing severely the government of Saddam Hussein at a time when Mr. Rumsfeld was visiting Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, when then Mr. Cheney was in support of our alliance with Saddam Hussein during the war between Iraq and Iran. Amnesty was not taking sides. Our job was to call it as we saw it, condemning human rights violations in Iraq, condemning human rights violations in Iran at the same time, and not tilting to one side or the other. We had a very cynical policy under Reagan and Mr. Bush.
Josh Rubenstein, Jack Beatty, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking this hour about Amnesty International's annual report out today, taking on the war on terror. I guess we're talking about really the tension between security and human rights, if that's the right way to put it. You can join the conversation. Is it possible that the war on terror has produced globally a net loss in human rights? Is Amnesty International thinking clearly here? Do you put the fight for human rights above the fight against terror. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Amnesty International's annual report, Big Book, out today, taking on the war on terror. We're talking about the tension between security and human rights. Maybe there's another way to frame it, but that's the way it's being framed right now. You can join the conversation. Do security and human rights have to be at odds? Is the American-led war on terror making the world a darker, more dangerous place? Or is the war on terror the only way to escape terror? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by our On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty, and by Josh Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International USA. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to call them in right away. Victor's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Victor. You're on the air.
Hello. Good evening.
Good evening.
You know, I really commend Amnesty International making it conscious of this war against terrorism, because you can add to the list the Baath terrorists, quote-unquote terrorists in Spain. You wonder why Spain was such a staunch ally of the United States against war in Iraq, and also the Uyghur population in China. You know, why don't we say anything about that?
Mm-hmm.
But it's a trade-off. I would err on the side of security, because you have to figure terrorism and these terrorists and these people who do these deplorable acts, they could care less about international law. They can care less about you and I or anybody. Their goal is to spread terror and cause mayhem and destruction and loss of life.
But, Victor, what about what we hear from Jack Beatty and Josh Rubenstein as well tonight, that when human rights are denied, the United States and others may actually be creating more terrorists?
Yeah, but what other way would you have it? What other solutions would you have? I mean, if we just stand there and allow terrorists to continue doing what they're doing, like they did in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Kenya, you know, those are forgotten. You heard about the horror that happened in Bali. You know, people are innocent. They're not part of the government. You know, they go on, they travel, their vacations, they want to enjoy themselves, because some terrorist organization has some problem against some Western government, people suffer.
And they end up
dead. What are you going to do?
Josh Rubenstein, how about it?
Victor, let me just say, we agree with you that U.S. government and other governments have an absolute right, they have an obligation to go after the people who committed these crimes and to protect us. I want to be protected as well. But I insist that the government act within our constitutional system and within the system of international law that the U.S. did so much to erect. And I don't think we should be running away from those principles in the face of these kinds of violence. I think we should be standing up for these principles and at the same time doing the police actions and even the military actions that may be necessary to protect us.
Victor, are you persuaded?
Good arguments, but no, I'll err on the side of security. And I'm military myself. I'm a Navy reservist, so I'm part of this, and I'll be part of the security effort probably in the future. But the way I see it is, I'll err on the side of security, unfortunately, but something has to be done until we all can come up with something better. But right now, we have to continue this war on terrorism, because unless they come up with a better way, they're going to continue the disrespect in our civil society.
But do you fear that down the road, Victor, you or your children may have fewer human rights yourself if this kind of environment of diminished human rights takes over in a war on terror?
It is a concern. I'm not so blinded that on the security side that may happen. But, you know, again, we have to come up with a better solution until we solve it. But right now, what else are we going to do? Are we going to allow them to continue to attack and blow up innocent civilians because they have a problem against the U.S. government? Or
Victor,
Australia?
We've got it. And Josh Rubenstein is shaking his head no. He's not for that, but he is for human rights. I want to welcome into our conversation Daniel Byman, joining us from Alexandria, Virginia. He's assistant professor at the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University, a senior fellow at the Savan Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Good evening and welcome, Dan Byman.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Dan Byman, I'm sure you have heard at least a summary of the Amnesty International report today. It's big and fat, as usual, reports on many countries and human rights violations. But the overall theme, the war on terror is eroding human rights around the world. Your thoughts?
Well, I think what the report did is, in a way, commendable and also in a way confusing. I commend Amnesty International for drawing attention, as they've done historically, to many parts of the world that have received insufficient attention, particularly in Africa. But by throwing the war on terrorism label onto this, they do what so many other people do, which is confuse what's going on in the war on terrorism with overall efforts with regard to security, with broader issues such as hunger, And when you throw all these categories together, it just results in confusion. I think, unfortunately, the report has some problems in that regard.
I don't quite see. How do you mean that they're all thrown together?
Well, there's an attempt to examine, for example, trade-offs between spending on terrorism and spending on hunger in the report. There's an attempt to talk about civil liberties at home and also the human rights abuses of numerous governments around the world. And when you look at all these things and then you say, in conclusion, the war on terrorism has made us less safe, you're throwing a whole bunch of different, very complex issues into under one banner. And unfortunately, I think that leads many people to be confused as to what's really going on.
But isn't if that's anyone's job, isn't it Amnesty International's job to take a kind of global reading and give us a bottom line?
I think it's Amnesty International's job to take a global reading of human rights and give us a bottom line, which they often do superbly. However, to try to grab, I think, I don't know, why exactly they chose this particular issue to focus so many different situations in the world on, I think actually detracts from their overall mission, which is highlighting the many causes of human rights abuses and the many ways to fight them.
And what about, Dan Byman, the core of that, which goes to the war on terrorism itself, and as you hear in everything that's written here and from Josh Rubenstein tonight, the call for human rights to be respected even in the midst of, in the prosecution of that so-called war on terror. Is that possible? Is that preferable to what's going on now?
I think that it's a mistake to think of it as either or. There are some issues where you clearly can respect human rights, and I think governments around the world, well, I shouldn't say that, some governments around the world try to do so. But what the report needs should focus on are some of the inherent trade-offs in this. One issue that's obvious to me is surveillance. How much intrusion in people's lives are acceptable in a free society? And before we say none, or before we say absolute, I think most of our listeners would agree that those extremes are probably a mistake. So the question is, what sort of balance to drive? And I don't think it's either or. I think it's where on the spectrum you want to be. You could say the same thing about an embrace of rather sordid governments, which I think the report does a very good job of highlighting. Clearly, the United States has had to make some allies of convenience in this war. But when is it too much? When a government like Uzbekistan, for example, which is poor by any scale of human rights, when do you say that this government is simply beyond the pale and we won't embrace it?
So define things in narrower terms by your lights. Has the war on terror contributed to a diminution of human rights? Well, I guess that's it.
I would say that in some countries, the U.S. war on terrorism has enabled governments to turn a blind eye or to conduct behavior that otherwise would receive a lot more scrutiny. But in the vast majority of these cases, again, let's take Uzbekistan as an example, this government was doing this before September 11th. Russians were behaving abysmally in Chechnya before September 11th. So I don't see the change as being the U.S. war on terrorism. I see this as largely problems that are related to particular governments. The difference is U.S. rhetoric against these countries has changed considerably and has largely been silent.
Josh Rubenstein, how about it? Several issues come up here. One is let's look first at the issue of surveillance. Dan Byman says that you may have to trim a little bit here and there to deal with exigencies that come up. Secondly, he's complaining about Amnesty's kind of holistic view of human rights and saying, don't confuse terror and hunger and everything else. Let's keep things in categories.
Well, let's go through these issues one by one quickly. Mm-hmm. I think there's a difference between expanding our surveillance methods in a reasonable way in the framework of our courts and warrants before judges and abiding and permitting torture and casting a blind eye when torture is taking place, either by our own military or by our allies. I think those are two different issues. Amnesty is not going to say there shouldn't be an expansion of surveillance. Maybe we do need to modernize our surveillance techniques because of the internet and fax machines and all of that. But that's a leap from acknowledging that to saying, yes, maybe we need to use rougher methods of interrogation. I think those are two different things, and we have to acknowledge it. Secondly, I think it is Amnesty's job to look broadly. And maybe that paints a bit of a blurry picture, but then read the report country by country. Read the individual instances of prisoners and what happens to them. The good stories of people who are released, the unfortunate stories where people are rounded up and not given trials, and a pattern does emerge of those countries that seem useful to to the U.S., the allies of convenience. We've seen that before during the Cold War. How many dictators did we support? How many regimes that relied on torture did we support to our chagrin in the long run? And that's what we are repeating now.
So, Jack Beatty, can you imagine a world, the United States, in which a national security advisor was an Amnesty International stalwart? Would it work?
Well, I mean, in effect, it seems to me the operation in Iraq is coming down to that. This was a human rights liberation because we're not finding the weapons of mass destruction. We're not establishing any connection with al-Qaeda. We liberated a people from really one of the worst governments on earth, mass graves, torture, on and on and on. So you could say an Amnesty International advisor came up with this war against Iraq. This is why it was fought on human rights grounds. And, you know, I remember...
But, of course, the report is critical of the war in Iraq. I mean, the comments coming out today in association with the report.
Sure. Understandably, but nothing like what you said about Saddam Hussein.
No.
And you know, the other thing is, I can remember in the back in the Carter administration, there was a woman who handled the Human Rights Office, Patricia Derian. I met a man from Argentina who'd been tortured. And he looked at me and he said, I'm alive today because of Patricia Derian, because James Earl Carter promoted a woman who confronted the Argentine government. And he said, what a wonderful thing to do. And I thought, yeah, isn't that what we want the United States to do? And my gosh, you talk about anti-terrorism. Isn't that the way to fight terrorism with justice?
Well, let me respond to the one point about Iraq. I agree. It does seem clear. The U.S. is now saying that the best way to justify the war in Iraq was that we overthrew this terrible tyrant. Mm. But then why isn't the U.S. doing more to secure these mass grave sites? Why isn't the U.S. doing more to provide, to allow human rights groups like Amnesty and others to develop systematic evidence about the human rights violations of the Saddam Hussein regime so that we can have proper tribunals? The U.S. is not rushing to do that.
Josh Rubenstein, hold that thought. Dan Byman, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Bill Frelick. He's joining us from Ottawa, Canada. He's Refugee Program Director for Amnesty International USA. He just returned from a research mission in Iraq. Hello, Bill Frelick.
Hi, happy to join you.
Happy to have you. Bill Frelick, we've just come around to the subject of Iraq. You've just been there. Jack Beatty says, well, it turns out that it's a human rights liberation, after all. Is that the way it looks to you as eyes and ears for Amnesty International?
Well, I would agree that the situation under Saddam Hussein was just egregious violations of human rights across the boards. But we went from a police state to anarchy. And talking to Iraqis on the street and in their homes during my mission as part of the Amnesty International delegation that was there, the fear is just endemic. People are afraid to go out of their houses. They're actually fearful inside their homes because there are roving bands that are operating with impunity in many places. They are quite frightened. They're frightened about their future. They don't know from day to day where to turn.
So are you doing then a quality critique on the quality of the prosecution of this war, or are you saying that they would have been better off left alone under Saddam Hussein?
Well, I mean, as I said before, the human rights abuses under Saddam Hussein were egregious. However, the situation today is one of vast insecurity. Again, we're in a period of transition. We don't know where things are heading. I don't think anyone does. But at the moment, there are killings that are happening, extrajudicial executions by unknown groups.
Yeah, we know that, Bill Frelick, but let me play the devil's advocate here. I can well imagine, I can hear the voice of Donald Rumsfeld saying, come on, Bill, you know, you want to make an omelet, you got to break some eggs. Would you rather just have us sit with the status quo globally, even when that includes bad guys like Saddam Hussein, with all the cataloged human rights abuses that Amnesty International has compiled?
Well, when you engage in a war, I guess breaking eggs. I mean, you do precipitate unknown consequences. And as I said, at this moment, from again my recently having been there, we seem to have gone really from one extreme to another, from police state to anarchy. And In terms of the security of people's lives, their day-to-day life, their feeling secure in terms of stepping out onto the street, their ability to report crimes in progress, it's simply not there at all.
Daniel Bynum, join us here. What do you think? Are we in for years and years of Amnesty International disapproving of the global context? We're told the war on terror is going to go on a long time.
Well, I think it's Amnesty International's job in general to disapprove, and I don't mean that critically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that in a positive way, that they are there to highlight the flaws, the abuses, whether it's simply neglect, as is, I think, in a few cases, or whether it's a really evil government. So, yes, at least I hope Amnesty International will keep criticizing. But in the war on terrorism, this is a generational struggle. I mean, you can talk about progress against al-Qaeda, you could talk about success in rounding up key leaders, but there is a generation of young Muslims that is very hostile to the United States and supportive of radical causes. And whether that generation, whether we are talking about hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, or even thousands or smaller numbers can pose quite a lethal threat.
So we know you're a security studies guy, Daniel mm-hmm. Bynum. Why don't you buy the more holistic approach that Amnesty International is taking here? The argument that's made is if you don't create a more just environment globally, you're going to create more terrorists, not fewer.
Well, the problem is that at least in both the policy analysis world and in the academic world, the findings on what leads individuals to embrace terrorism are actually quite troubling. The answer is not poverty, quite the opposite. Very poor countries tend to not have a terrorism problem. They have a war problem, they have a governance problem, but not a terrorism problem. The answer tends to be countries that are doing better, that are improving, but are not there yet. They're in transitional stages. And in these cases, the result is you see terrorism in the Middle East, which is wealthier than Africa, and you see much more like traditional civil strife in Africa. And the Amnesty International approach would seem to suggest that by trying to raise standards in Africa, you would decrease the potential for terrorism, when, in fact, I think it's actually the opposite. Now, to be fair, I think you definitely want development in Africa to end war there, to decrease civil war, to decrease violence, but you don't want to conflate war on terrorism with overall civil strife, because they're very different things.
Josh Rubenstein, 1 minute before the break.
I think it's very hard to make these distinctions so clearly, Professor Bynum. It's very hard to say what leads to terrorism. I know there are all kinds of academic studies, but the fact of that matter is that civil strife, turmoil, all kinds of resentments against prosperous governments like the United States, all of these things are kind of a jumble that lead to these kinds of political violence, which we use this broad label of terrorism.
So you say, bring us more human rights, and you feel an underlying confidence, despite Dan Bynum's observation, that there will be fewer terrorists.
I'm not saying that human rights is a panacea. I'm saying you have to use police action. You have to bring people mm-hmm. to justice, but you have to uphold human rights as you do it. Otherwise, you undermine your own efforts. Mm.
Stand by. Josh Rubenstein, Dan Bynum, Jack Beattie, Bill Frelick in Ottawa, Canada, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Bill Frelick is Refugee Program Director for Amnesty International USA. We're talking about Amnesty International's annual report out today, taking on the war on terror. Who's being realistic here, Amnesty International or George W. Bush? Has the war on terror given carte blanche to despots around the world to torture, kill, and imprison political enemies? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Amnesty International's annual report out today, taking on the war on terror. You can join the conversation. Is the American-led war on terror making the world a darker, more dangerous place? Or is the war on terror the only way to escape terror? We're at 1-800-423-8255. My guest tonight, Josh Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International USA. From Alexandria, Virginia, Daniel Bynum, Assistant Professor at the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University, and with us in the studio tonight, Jack Beattie. You're welcome to join us as well. Abe is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Abe. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for a wonderful show. I agree with the a previous caller that maybe Amnesty have chosen the easy way out. We are all for human rights, but I think it's more complex than that. And I'll just bring up one scenario, the so-called ticking bomb scenario, where you have an individual that intelligence tells you that he has a specific knowledge about the threat within hours or days of a terrorist act, let's say attack on New York or Boston, and you have to extract the information from this individual. So what would you do? Would you call in a lawyer to protect his civil rights? Would you compromise some human rights?
Got it, Abe. You take us right down to the heart of at least one angle of this matter, and I thank you for raising that. Let me put it to you, Josh Rubenstein. Of course, here's the ticking bomb scenario.
Sure.
The nuke is in Manhattan.
Right,
you've got the suspect. Do you break his legs or?
Right. We're all clever enough to think of a scenario that seems to just point the way to a clear-headed response, you know. But in fact, every government that invokes that kind of scenario in the real world expands its use of torture and uses it routinely. We saw that for the British in Northern Ireland. We saw that for the French in Algeria. We see that for the Israelis in their conflict with the Palestinians. They all say they need to use these kinds of methods in response to a very narrowly defined set of circumstances in the most extreme circumstances. But once they train people to do it, they end up using it in hundreds and thousands of cases that have no similarity to this ticking bomb situation.
So you're saying don't sanction this. Don't ever sanction
it. Once you sanction it and you think you're only sanctioning it for this most narrow, well-defined, extreme, compelling circumstance, you end up using it in a very loose and relaxed way, because interrogators and police establishments think that's the efficient way to combat terrorism, so to combat their opponents, and they end up using it against hundreds and thousands of prisoners.
Dan Byman, I have to say, the Amnesty International argument can be pretty persuasive sometimes. No one wants that to ripple out. You're in security studies. What's the kind of word in your circles? To the specific point, do you believe that human rights can or should on occasion or routinely be set aside in the interests of fighting terrorism?
Again, it's not either or.
Isn't there a choice?
At times in a very urgent situation, you bend the rules, or you may even have to break them at times. Now, I agree strongly with what the Amnesty International representative said, that this is routinely used as an excuse, as a pretext that goes way beyond the original intention, but the color raises real possibilities. This actually does happen from time to time in a terrorism world, where you will catch one individual who is part of a bomb team. You know the rest of the bomb team is out there. They are about to set a bomb off. And what do you do in these circumstances? It is too glib to say that, oh, you don't worry about it because overall you corrupt the system. Some people will die, and it is very hard to say that the deaths of innocents is a legitimate price for this. And the result is you have to think about ways to bend the rules. You have to think about procedures. And the ideal is we have this debate in advance, that you're not relying on the officer on the street, on the individual responsible to make these decisions, but rather there are a set of procedures. And if we ignore this problem, if we pretend that these situations never happen, it's only going to make things worse when they actually do.
But Josh Rubenstein says if you sanction this in advance, you will ultimately be giving sanction to broader abuses of human rights.
Well, the key is monitoring. The key is oversight. You need congressional oversight. It needs to be bipartisan. You need more than one agency or group overseeing each other. This is the sort of thing we have in a democratic society to prevent abuses of all sorts. And if you have proper oversight, it can be done.
Jack Beatty, come in here. What's your bottom line? Do you believe that we can have a fully effective police action campaign against terrorism and at the same time uphold human rights with all the splendor and beauty that Amnesty International would like us to, that we all would like to?
Well, I mean, I it seems to me the war on terror is a military and police war, to be sure, but it's also a political war. It's about our values. And one of the things we're trying to say to the Muslim world at large, especially these aggrieved young men, is, you know, we are for democracy in your part of the world. Well, that's the antithesis of human rights violations. So to the degree that we hurt ourselves on the human rights front, we're actually weakening ourselves on the political fight for hearts and minds in the Middle East. But, you know, there's a practical question here, too. We're in the real world, things happen. I mean, there were those cases, I think, of the nine jetliners that were going to be blown up going across the Pacific.
Out of Manila toward the U.S.
As I understand it, that was torture that got that information out of whoever it was that was going to be doing this. Now, do I regret that
I don't know what to say about that. It wasn't our torture. It was the Philippines government that did it. But we knew it was going to happen. Aren't we glad, in a way, that it did happen?
Well, again, it's easy to say in one case or another, yes, there it was justified looking back. But how many times did the government of the Philippines use torture on people mm-hmm. who had no connection to mm-hmm. terrorism? Mm-hmm. So do we give them a free pass mm-hmm. this one time? Mm-hmm. Are more lives saved? Are more lives lost in the long run? The job of the human rights organization is to stand up for these principles. And if there are those who feel that from time to time they have to be broken, then they cannot do it with impunity. Mm-hmm. And they cannot pretend that they are owed impunity when they break those principles. Mm.
Phil is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. As a segue from this current conversation, mm-hmm. I'd just like to say that I don't recall anybody giving the United States the right to be the world's policeman. Second of all, there are far worse governments in the world than the Iraqi government. Let me just point out one, for example, the Sudan, where they have the Muslims who run the country from the north have enslaved the Dinka black Christians of the south and are massacring them with impunity. So we've got a two-faced appearance here. But what I really want to address is that my understanding is that al-Qaeda, which was represented by 37 foreign young men of a particular ethnic and religious identity, have caused this nation to abrogate the constitutional rights of 280 million people here. That this government has the right now, through the Homeland Security Act, which was passed by all but one senator, to go into anybody's mail, to go without any court order into anybody's home, to invade anybody's, to bug anybody's phone that they want to, that they deem for some reason or other that they have the right to do. This is our First Amendment.
Phil, we've got it. So the bill has landed right here in the United States. Our time is running down, so I want to take that. Thanks for your call, Phil. Josh Rubenstein, Phil brings up again the price on the home front of the war on terror.
Well, I think we were too quick to pass those laws, like the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act. I think many people in Congress are having second thoughts, both over those bills and Patriot II, which even expands the government's powers. I think people are now having second thoughts and are regretting that they gave the Bush administration such carte blanche after 9/11. But that was a result, a consequence of the fear and anxiety that overtook us.
Josh, does Amnesty International have Washington's ear any longer? Jack Beatty was pointing out earlier, the State Department has historically cited your work. Is that all finished now that the U.S. is starting to take heat from Amnesty?
I hope not. I think they understand the role we play, that they rely on us for our human rights reporting. After all, there are 151 countries listed here, described here. We haven't touched on any of the so-called routine human rights violations, the garden variety violations like slavery in Mauritania and repression of the press in Zimbabwe or torture in Albania. I mean, this goes on in scores of countries that virtually has no connection to the war on terrorism. But our job is to think of these forgotten places, the forgotten prisoners of conscience, whether it's the war on terrorism or whether it's the more garden variety routine violations that go on year after year, decade after decade. Mm.
Josh Rubenstein, we're glad you're out there doing your job, and thanks very much for it. And thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Josh Rubenstein is Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International USA. And Daniel Byman, thank you very much for joining the conversation this evening.
It was my pleasure.
Dan Byman is Assistant Professor at the Security Study Program at Georgetown University. Jack Beatty, this is going to go on and on and on as a conversation. It's kind of sickening to be trapped in it.
Yes, to have to deal with questions like, would you sanction torture here or not? But those are the sorts of alternatives that are being forced
and
on them.
Decisions are being made by the way the United States acts every day. We're deciding through action.
Yes, yes. And as someone just said, 37 people have affected the rights of 250 million, however severely.
Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, Pulitzer Prize winner Thomas Friedman on thriving in the age of terror. This is On Point. Three-time Pulitzer Prize winner Thomas Friedman is no stranger to terrorism and uncertainty. In the early 80s, Friedman was the New York Times bureau chief in Beirut during Lebanon's civil war. He served as the paper's Jerusalem bureau chief. More recently, he spent months traveling across the Middle East, interviewing Muslims for a Discovery Channel documentary called Searching for the Roots of 9/11. Friedman was keynote speaker at Yale University's Class Day this past weekend. He told the class of 2003 that years of reporting from terrorism-torn nations has taught him one thing, that successful people are those who accept the uncertainties of life. Here are excerpts from Tom Friedman's speech.
In this age of terrorism, when we know so much about all the threats out there, you basically have two choices of how to live your life. One is to be a survivor, and the other is to be a thriver. Be a thriver. I first learned about survivors and thrivers as a reporter in Beirut during the Lebanese Civil War in the late 1970s. Beirut in those days was a city wracked with terrorism and violence, with car bombs exploding regularly and street fighting between various Lebanese factions, a routine feature of daily life. So much so that it was reported like the weather. Indeed, when Beirutis asked each other, "How is it outside?" they were not referring to the temperature or chance of precipitation, but rather the security climate in the streets. In this absurd and wacky environment, a psychologist friend of mine, Richard Day, often spoke to me about two personality types, thrivers and survivors. The survivors were Lebanese who took in way too much information and suffered from system overload. If they saw an Israeli plane flying overhead, they would say, "Oh my God, that's an Israeli plane. It might drop a bomb. I'm dropping everything and running home to my basement. See you later." Survivors were called survivors because they were just barely getting by. They spent all of their days worrying about every conceivable threat. Thrivers, by contrast, were people who learned to live with uncertainty mainly by learning to view their environment very selectively. They would see an Israeli plane going overhead and say, "Hey, there's an Israeli plane going overhead. I don't think it's here to bomb me or my neighborhood. I'm going golfing." There is no such thing as perfect security in today's world. Rational precautions should be taken, but once you've done that, you basically have to decide, am I going to sit home in the basement forever, or am I going to get on with my life? Get on with your lives. Do that trip abroad, spend that year overseas, go to that Yale Law School. And whatever mind games it takes to get you out the door are just fine. I had a friend in Beirut who always used to joke that, for safety's sake, every time she flew on an airplane, she wanted to carry a bomb in her suitcase because the odds of two people carrying a bomb on the same plane were so much higher. Maybe whatever it takes, but get out the door. We must not overreact to 9/11. My daughter's high school orchestra trip from Washington to Orleans was canceled this year because the school board's fear of terrorism. I thought this was absolutely nuts. At some point, you have to ask whether Al-Qaeda operatives are really sitting around a cave in Afghanistan and saying, "Hey, Osama, you remember that high school orchestra competition in New Orleans? Well, it's coming up again next week. Let's really make a splash and go after it." No, I don't think so. Let's leave the cave dwelling to Osama bin Laden. Be thrivers, not survivors. I promise you, it's never as scary out there as the newspapers say.
New York Times columnist Tom Friedman speaking at Class Day at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.